The next case this morning is number 013302, Darius Scott against the Commissioner of Social Security. Mr. Corson.
Morning. May it please the Court, my name is Stephen Corsi. I'm here representing the plaintiff and appellant, Darius Scott. When Darius Scott appeared before the administrative law judge for his child's SSI disability hearing, he argued that he suffered from mild mental retardation, which satisfied the commissioner's requirements for finding of disability. The specific requirement satisfied was listing 112.05.
Could I quickly ask you a question? Looking at the ALJ's opinion appended to your brief, at the bottom of page 2, where he begins the summary and evaluation of the evidence, it says, the record shows that the claimant filed an application for child supplemental security income benefits on October 1st, 93, alleging disability since August 29 because of hyperactivity. Period. And I wanted to make sure that the claim of mental impairment was in this case properly at the time it was before the ALJ.
Yes, it absolutely was, Your Honor. You're correct that when Darius Scott's mother filed the application pro se, she wrote hyperactivity. At the time of the hearing, however, Darius Scott was represented, and his counsel, Rebecca Saunders, was given the opportunity to present an opening statement. And in her opening statement, she said quite directly that the claim was one of mental retardation. And she specifically stated that it was plaintiff's position that Darius Scott satisfied the requirements of listing 112.05. And not only was it asserted, evidence in support of that claim was submitted. That evidence consisted of IQ test scores showing full-scale IQ of 69 and a verbal IQ of 68, numbers which satisfy the significantly sub-average general intellectual functioning requirement of the listing. There was also evidence submitted both in terms of testing, the Vineland test of adaptive behavior, showing significant and varied deficits of adaptive functioning. These are the two criteria set forth in the listing for establishing retardation. In addition, and as a result of this evidence, Scott also presented the diagnosis of the clinical psychologist who tested him in June of 1995, finding that he was, in fact, suffering from mild mental retardation. So not only was the claim made, but evidence was submitted in support of that claim.
Well, is your principal argument that the ALJ doesn't come to grips with all of these various tests that show him at the 68, 69, 70 level using these numbers?
Well, yes. This court has imposed upon administrative law judges certain obligations. One of those obligations is that the administrative law judge is not free to ignore uncontradicted evidence. Way back in 1985, in the Look case, this court said that such is impermissible and constitutes an error of law. Here, the administrative law judge ignores the test scores, ignores the Vineland scores of adaptive functioning. So this is one violation. A second violation, if you determine that he in fact did not ignore this evidence, he did nonetheless fail to articulate his reason for rejecting it. The administrative law judge had before him at the time of the hearing a diagnosis of mild mental retardation. There was nothing in the record conflicting with that diagnosis. The administrative law judge did not have a medical advisor present at the hearing, and so there was just nothing in to conflict or to refute the diagnosis and the consequences of that diagnosis, which would be satisfying the commissioner's listing. So the ALJ's second obligation, as this court has held on many occasions, is to articulate his reasons for accepting or rejecting evidence. and to build a bridge between the evidence and the conclusion. Now, despite the evidence showing mild mental retardation, what the judge said is that, and I quote, that Scott seems not to be significantly limited in his cognitive functioning. Now, there's simply no basis in the record for making such a conclusion, and the judge had no medical source on which he could rely to make such a conclusion. So I believe that the judge did, number one, ignored evidence, number two, failed to articulate his reasons for rejecting evidence, and number three, apparently rejected this evidence without the support of a medical source, which constitutes what this court has often called playing doctor. And all three of those constitute errors of law and mean that the judge's decision is unsupported by substantial evidence.
Now, what would happen to you on remand where, do you agree that the 1996 amendments would apply to Darius Scott's case upon a remand, and that these create a more stringent standard for the
Yes, award? They would apply. However, the listing, 112.05, was the listing before the 96 amendments and continues to be the listing to this day. So if we are correct that his impairment satisfies the requirements of a listing, then his claim would be approved.
Mm-hmm. And then would you be able to supplement with more recent information if it were sent back?
Yes, that's the general procedure, that it is permissible to submit all evidence available at the time of any subsequent administrative law judge hearing.
In this case, I notice, when was the change in the law?
1996, August 22nd, the day after the administrative law judge's decision, before the decision of the appeals council.
How old is your client now?
He's 11.
How old was he when he filed all this?
Well, the application was filed when he was 3.
Where was this case from 1996 to 1999?
Sitting at the Appeals Council. The Appeals Council of the Social Security Administration has incredibly long delays, and that's exactly where it was during this period of time. An appeal of the judge's decision was filed almost immediately after receipt of the decision, and by rule, it has to be filed within 60 days. As I indicated, there were a significant body of evidence presented which established the satisfaction of the requirements for mental retardation. Scott is also required under the specific subsections that we argue, subsections D and F, to show another distinct impairment, which has what the rule calls significant limitations of functioning.
The real difficulty in this case is determining whether those are really separate from the mental retardation.
Well, although we have certainly plenty of guidance to help us here. Number one is that the hyperactivity is completely separated from his intellectual functioning. There is no logical connection between poor intellectual functioning and hyperactivity. Secondly, the doctors who examined Scott found that he suffered both from mild mental retardation and from expressive and receptive speech disorders. Now, the commissioner argues that this in fact explains the IQ scores, but I'd like to point out two things that I believe refute that argument. Number one is the psychologist did diagnose retardation. She was in possession of testing scores from tests that had been performed in 1994 and tests that had been performed in 1995 and had school records for the intervening year when she made her assessment. So she was in a position to determine that there was retardation. She was also in a position, however, to assess Scott's language functioning. And Scott's language functioning is very, very low. In fact, his deficits in this area are more severe than his deficits in his cognitive functioning. And this is shown by the fact that although his IQ, his full-scale and verbal IQ, is in the mildly mentally retarded range, his testing results in both 1994 and 1995 found that his language development was at least in the moderately retarded range of development. And according to the DSM-IV, cited both by our side and the commissioner, the DSM-IV states that when the testing shows a markedly more severe language impairment than cognitive functioning, that they're distinct impairments. So we believe that testing shows that the language is in fact a distinct impairment, and that the lay evidence and evidence from the school shows that the hyperactivity is distinct from the cognitive impairment as well.
Thank you, Mr. Corsi.
Thank you.
We'll now hear from Mr. Young.
Good morning. May it please the court, Rick Young on behalf of the commissioner. Plaintiff argues that the ALJ should have found he met the listing for mental retardation. However, in order to meet any listing, including the listing for mental retardation, a claimant must first establish that he satisfies the diagnostic criteria for that impairment. Here, substantial evidence supports the ALJ's finding that plaintiff did not satisfy that diagnostic description. Although plaintiff had some IQ scores that were within the mental retardation range, IQ scores are not dispositive evidence of mental retardation.
How do we know that that's what the ALJ thought? I mean, even the district judge comment on this, it's a very brief opinion. The actual text of it goes on for about a page and a half when you delete, you know, the repetition in the summary and the setting up of a situation. I just don't know whether the ALJ thought of the things you've mentioned in your brief. Maybe he could have, but I don't know if he did.
Well, I would agree with the magistrate judge's comments that the decision is not a model of clarity, but I think the one thing that is clear, if nothing else, is the ALJ found that this claimant did not have mental retardation.
But why? I mean, with all of these tests, don't you think he needed to explain for the benefit of, you know, the appeals counsel, for the benefit of reviewing courts, why all of these doctors were wrong?
I don't think all these doctors were wrong, Your Honor. Dr. Vachslag, who is the doctor who performed the most extensive evaluation of plaintiff in 1994, did not diagnose mental retardation. She diagnosed an expressive and receptive language disorder. That impairment is an impairment separate and distinct from mental retardation.
That he makes reference to that report, because that was Exhibit 18, but isn't that the only specific reference he has to what a doctor has said in terms of the rationale and the reason? Because I'm not finding a bridge here between, you know, what the what was found by the administrative law judge and his actual conclusion, because there's no real discussion.
Well, Your Honor, I think that you can trace the path of the analysis. He cites the test results from Dr. Vachslag's examination as well as Dr. Vachslag's report, and then he quotes verbatim the conclusions of Dr. Lord. Our position is that both those reports are essentially consistent.
His quote from Dr. Lord says he's at the upper end of the mild range of mental retardation, and yet in the face of this very language that he's quoted, he's decided that he's not in the upper end of the mild range of mental retardation. Can we understand why he is sort of selectively taking Dr. Lord's findings? Does he think Dr. Lord was using bad procedures in part of her testing? Does he think this is not a good test? What's wrong with her conclusion, which he quotes, that he's in the range of mental retardation, albeit the upper end of the mild range?
Well, I think the key there, Your Honor, is that was not a diagnosis. She was referring to the intelligence testing that that Dr. Lord had performed.
What's the diagnosis in your view?
The diagnosis, in my view, would be the diagnosis made by Dr. Vachslag.
No, what is a diagnosis? What's the word mean? Does a doctor have to have a page that says diagnosis at the top of it?
Well, frequently...
It says, Darius is a 4.5-year-old boy who is currently functioning at the upper end of the mild range of mental retardation. Does that mean she doesn't think he's at the mild range of mental retardation?
Well, you frequently see doctors list their diagnosis, especially in psychological impairments, on various axes, as Dr. Boxleit did in his case.
Is that required as a matter of law?
I would not say that is required as a matter of law, Your Honor, no. However, if you read Dr. Lord's report as a whole, it's clear that what she was referring to is the result of his testing, that he was functioning within the mental retardation range on the testing, not that he had a diagnosis of mental retardation. And that's important because you have to look at the purpose of the evaluation that Dr. Lord was performing. She was on staff at the University of Chicago, and she was performing a follow-up evaluation to assess the progress of plaintiff in the year after the examination performed by Dr. Boxleit.
Progress vis-a-vis himself or progress vis-a-vis peer children?
His progress overall,
his
Your Honor.
His progress. So he could have gotten to the point of 5 to 6 word sentences, whereas other children at the age of 4.5 will talk your ear off, speak in many paragraphs. Does that mean that if he moves from 3 to 4 up to 5 to 6 that he's not mentally impaired?
Well, Your Honor, he was improving in the time between the examination by Dr. Voxflag and Dr. Lord. Dr. Lord did not diagnose mental retardation.
Well, she says he's mildly mentally retarded.
I'm sorry, Dr. Voxflag, however, who performed the initial evaluation, did not diagnose mental retardation. At no point did she refer to mental retardation.
Why doesn't the administrative law judge come to grips with these various? There are a bunch of doctors. There's Dr. Hermsmeyer, there's Dr. Virginia Bishop Townsend, there's the original. When it's a very little boy test by Dr. Boxleiter, I mean, we don't have very much help for this boy who, understand what the evaluation of the agency is of him. There's just a bottom line.
Well, none of the other physicians that you mentioned, one was a state agency reviewer, the other was a pediatrician. Neither of those physicians referred to a cognitive disorder, nor mental retardation, nor language disorder. So I'm not sure that those opinions were particularly relevant to determining whether or not plaintiff meets the listing for mental retardation. I think the key opinion was that of Dr. Voxflag, and then followed up by Dr. Lord, who was performing a follow-up examination, acknowledged Dr. Voxflag's original diagnosis of an extensive and receptive language disorder, and at no point refuted that diagnosis. Now, yes, she did indicate that plaintiff was functioning within the mental retardation range on intelligence testing. But as plaintiff points out, I believe correctly, in his reply brief, intelligence testing performed by Dr. Voxleit also indicated he was functioning within the mental retardation range. In particular, Dr. Voxleit performed the McCarthy scales of children's abilities. And the results showed on the cognitive index portion that he had an IQ of roughly 50. Nonetheless, Dr. Voxleit did not diagnose mental retardation, diagnosed a language disorder. This is a separate and distinct impairment.
And, of course, nothing is discussed in the ALJ's opinion to the effect of the argument you're making here.
That's correct, Your Honor. But I don't think there's a great need to discuss those. Well, I shouldn't say that, but I think you can nonetheless trace the path of his analysis and that the opinions are essentially consistent. I don't think there was a great need for the ALJ in this case to dwell into the IQ scores like plaintiff's counsel has done and sort of interpret their meaning. You essentially had, I believe, one psychologist, the one who performed the most extensive evaluation, diagnosing a language disorder, not mental retardation. You had the second psychologist performing a follow-up examination and not refuting that diagnosis. Certainly, if plaintiff's condition had deteriorated, and all of a sudden, or that if Dr. Lord felt that the diagnosis of a language disorder was inappropriate, Dr. Lord would have mentioned that. She never did. In fact, the evidence before Dr. Lord indicated that plaintiff was improving. After the initial evaluation, he was placed in special education programs with a focus on communication skills. As he participated in those programs, the evidence indicates his communication skills began to improve, and lo and behold, his IQ score shot up.
Well, shot up is a pretty... I mean, I don't know where the evidence in the record is of that, but it's... again, there are your arguments, which may all be very fine arguments if we had any clue that the ALJ thought about them. And there's also, a methodological issue. If somebody improves from the point where they can't be toilet trained to the point where they can be, that's a big improvement. But it doesn't mean that the person is a functioning adult. You need a lot more. And I'm concerned that there isn't the kind of peer comparison. We know that he can do 5 to 6 word sentences. We know that he's in the mild range of mental retardation. He's managing to do a few more things, but how that relates to where he should be seems to be utterly absent from this record.
Well, Your Honor, the only issue that plaintiff is challenging is whether or not the plaintiff met the listing.
Right.
The step we use to evaluate claims for children goes beyond that, of course, and goes more into issues
right.
of functional equivalence. That's something that's not an issue in this case. I'm not sure we need to do that type of stringent comparison with other students in terms of, or children, in terms of determining whether or not the claimant meets the listing for mental retardation.
Well, only because you seem to be disregarding test scores as saying, oh, those are just IQ test scores and we don't pay any attention to them. That's why I was trying to look at the rest of the picture, none of which looks very normal to me either.
Well, I don't mean to insinuate that we disregard the test scores, Your Honor. What I'm saying is that they're not dispositive. And here, the
first... Do they have any weight, in your view?
Well, certainly. You consider IQ scores in determining whether or not there's an appropriate diagnosis for mental retardation, but they're not a specific requirement. And moreover, we rely more upon the opinions of the psychologists in this record, who, in my opinion, do not diagnose mental retardation, instead diagnose a language disorder. And then finally, just with respect to the... even assuming plaintiff had mental retardation, as Judge Ripple indicated, I don't think you can show that he had a second impairment that caused distinct and additional limitations stemming from that. There was, as plaintiff acknowledges, evidence of an expressive and receptive language disorder. There is no evidence that that was an impairment separate and apart from mental retardation. The only psychologist who diagnosed that made that diagnosis in lieu of a diagnosis for mental retardation. There was also evidence of a hyperactivity disorder. But once again, neither of the psychologists made that as a second diagnosis. The pediatrician did. However, there was some suggestion that any limitations stemming from that are overlapping and not in addition to any type of developmental disorder. So unless you have anything further, Your Honor, I have nothing.
Thank you, Mr. Young.
Thank you.
Mr. Corsi, I believe that your time had expired, so the case will be taken under submission with the court's thanks to both counsel.